Well, another man that I feel very proud of having brought here is Eric Vogt. He was at Chalk River. He is some 15 years younger than I am. And he was still a student at Princeton at the time the Chalk River work was going on, but eventually he got his PhD at Princeton, began working at Chalk River. I invited him for a couple of weeks lectures during the summer, and when he came over here, I again took active promotion. I knew that he was interested in the outdoors and hiking, so we hiked all over the North Shore. And I then said, Eric, don't you think that he had a family of five kids? Don't you think this is a good place to bring up children? And he agreed, and so he came over here. He participated in the early work with the Van de Graaff generator that we had here, which has long gone in the outlet. And then, of course, being very instrumental, he and the late Dr. Warren, who also was one of the people that was in the Montreal lab, one of the British scientists, the Montreal lab, who went back to England, but very soon after that wrote me a letter and said that I don't think that life in England is going to be very good in the post-war period. You were talking about UBC when we were at Montreal. How's chances there? Well, I said the chances are very good. So he came out and was head of the nuclear physics group within the physics department, and probably half the nuclear physics professors in Canada at the moment are products of his lab here. He was very successful. And then he and Eric Vogt, when he came, and myself assisting from the sidelines, were instrumental in getting the Triumph project line.
What sort of was the background to that and getting it started, and why UBC?
Well, because ideas are born in the minds of people, and wherever the people are, that's what's going to happen. University of California, at the time I went there, just had passed through a transition from what UBC used to be in my undergraduate days, and it acquired people like Oppenheimer and Lawrence and Macmillan and Alvarez, and sort of took off. Now, why was it able to acquire those that kind of a person? Well, I think these young and ambitious people didn't want to get mixed up with the old fuddy-duddies in Harvard and Princeton and Yale, where they knew best and the young people wouldn't be able to get ahead. Yes. They wanted to go out to a place that was just ripe for flowering. Mm-hmm. And also, climate and living conditions have a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. That, as Shrum used to say, well, we have sort of a $3,000 advantage on salary in British Columbia because people prefer to live here than in Saskatoon.
But there was more to it than
that. No, there wasn't.
Well, the money. I mean, it was, what, $30 million?
Yeah.
Which at the time and even now is a lot of money.
Yeah,
so how did that?
Well, once you have people with A, an idea, B, an energy, and C, salesmanship talents, you have to put all these three things together, and Eric Vogt in particular exemplifies all these things. I mean, he's still quite confident that the Kaon factory will go through. I mean, I was always the pessimist. I said, well, now it's going to be difficult, etc. Never mind. We just go ahead and do it.
Yeah.
And I think as an accident of history, we here at UBC were proposing a project, a novel project, and it was based on an idea of Reginald Richardson, who was working at UCLA, and he and John Warren knew each other and were discussing the possibility that this particular kind of a cyclotron called a sector-focused cyclotron, etc., which had not been tried anywhere else and had certain advantages which have been since amply justified, that this would be a good thing to do. So Reggie Richardson came up here as a visitor first and developed these plans, and as you say, it was a big amount of money, $30 million. At the same time, in Chalk River, another British physicist who was head of the science department at Chalk River, they were doing an intense neutron generator, shortly called ING, I-N-G. Mm-hmm. The ING project was to cost $300 million. Well, both projects came before the financial authorities in Ottawa at about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the $300 million was just too much for the finances of the day to swallow. So although it was a good project, a lot of jealousy was generated by the engineers across Canada, because they say that's just an engineering thing and they'll swallow up the whole budget and there won't be anything left for us, etc. So the ING project was canceled. So they canceled the ING project, and I guess they decided they couldn't kill all of science in Canada at the same time, so the triumph went through.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, $30 million seemed like a reasonable thing compared to $300.
Exactly. Are you still involved at all with Triumph today?
No.
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 So after you were head of the Department of Physics, then you became Dean of the Faculty of Science in 1972.
That's correct.
And you were Dean for 7 years. For 7 years.
Yeah, I retired in 79.
That's right,
yeah.
Excuse me. What did you see, what changes did you see that should be made, or did you, or what issues, or what was important at the time when you became Dean and through your time there?
Well, the important of the time was that I've been lucky all my life, and I managed to sort of escape the difficulties. It was only during my last two or three years of deanship that the budgetary problems of the university became really acute.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the idea was to hold on to what you had and not give up too much to the central financial budget of the university.
Mm-hmm.
During my time, I guess one new department was added. The Institute of Oceanography became a Department of Oceanography within the Faculty of Science. And the rest of the time as a dean, as I was telling my selection committee at the time, I said that the faculty is a very strong one, with several very strong heads of departments, Charles McDowell, particularly in chemistry, and that the departments know how to run themselves. And sort of my function, as I see it, is to be the umpire, that they don't step on each other's toes too much.
Mm-hmm. What about with students? Were you involved as dean with the students?
No, I was had a very good associate dean that I selected, was who succeeded me as Dean Cy Finnegan.
Mm-hmm.
So that we had a very clear division of responsibility. I was the person who chaired the committees on selection of new faculties, new heads, and so on, and argued about money with the president's office.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as the university grew, the administration proliferated.
Mm-hmm.
In the days when I started, there was no such animal as a vice president, but the dean wanted to argue directly with the president. By the way, I wore out six presidents in the course of my life at the university. I started under President Clink, and then proceeded through the Mackenzie era, and McDonald, Hare, and Kenny.
That's right.
So I gradually wore them all out.
You wore them all out.
Yeah.
You personally.
I personally, that's right. And at the sort of level, it became more bureaucratic, in that instead of the dean going to the president to argue, and the president sort of knowing whatever happens, there were the vice presidents, and you went to the vice president went to the president, and sort of things got changed in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I was concerned, I guess it's inevitable, but to me it was not the way to run the university, however.
You want the direct line to the top authority.
That's right.
Exactly.
So that I think it's less fun being a dean now than it was when I started being a dean, but it was less fun when I finished. And, I had no regrets. While I was dean, I had kept on advising the people in the faculty who were ready to retire. I said, well, retire with good grace. Don't try to hang on. That don't you think it's better to go with a golden handshake and everybody can congratulate you and so on, and wait, well, look now, old boy, you really can't cut the mustard anymore, you better go. This isn't the way it should be. And when my time came, I could have asked for, you know, a year and a half. I said, nothing doing. I'm just, that's what I've been telling my faculty, and that's what I'm going to do.
That's what he
that's it.
Lived by your words.
Yeah. And as usual, the retirement is as of 30th of June.
Mm-hmm.
So came the fall, our beautiful September, and the bright young things coming on the campus and so on. And I walked past the dean's office, and I kind of felt a little twinge of nostalgia. So I went in, and there was my former associate dean sitting behind the desk, and I started talking to Cy. Well, Cy, how are things going? And he told me how they were not going, and I left in 10 minutes. My nostalgia was completely cured. I never looked back since.
In addition to being dean, you were also on the Senate.
Well, that's all deans are members of Senate. And, well, first I was an elected member from the faculty. Well, as far as I'm concerned, I don't really feel that I've contributed anything much to the Senate myself, nor do I think that the Senate, as too big a body, that has a lot of talk and not too much action.
It's a huge body now,
isn't
it? It is
a huge body, that's right.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And also student representatives on the Senate. I read in the paper that something like 17 have been elected, so...
Yeah, well, sure, the number of faculties has proliferated, and along with that, the number of deans, and along with that, the number of student representatives, and it gets bigger and bigger.
So where are the decisions being made now about the university? I mean, do you think it's, is it the president who's just deciding, or is there no focus? Or?
Well, I think, as always, it's the bigger an organization gets, the more difficult it is, because now in the era of so-called participatory democracy, you just can't operate the way either Clink or McKenzie did. McKenzie always used to appoint committees, and if the committee didn't come out with what he wanted, he would appoint another committee, and then eventually when he appointed a committee that agreed with the decision, there it is, you see.
Well, obviously, since you retired, you haven't really retired. You're involved in other things apart from university.
Before I retired, I had one job. I was the dean.
Mm-hmm.
When I retired, I suddenly acquired four jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to tell my friends that, you know, when you retire, you just take on more. So that my four jobs were that, I don't know what order I can name them, but I think I'll name them in the order that I was most attracted to. The year before I retired as dean, I was offered the job of editing this journal that I was mentioning earlier, the Spiegel. And I asked them, could they not please wait a year till I retire? No, they said, we need the editor now. If you don't take it, we'll have to give it to somebody else. So I said, okay, I'll take the job. And I took it. and I wrote a pastoral letter to my stable of translators saying that I still have this other job to do, but wait till next year and I'll then be able to devote more time to our affairs. One of them, who is himself was a retired physicist, wrote back a nice letter, congratulated, and said, I have two unsolicited comments on retirement. One is that you probably, like the rest of us, have saved up all kinds of wonderful projects that you'll do when you retire. Well, I have news for you that you'll be able to do one or maybe two of those projects, and the others will still be on the shelf. Well, he was so right. 11 years later, I have many projects on the shelf. The other one, he says, is I often wondered, before I myself retired, why some of my colleagues who retired ahead of me continued leading happy and healthy lives, and the others went to seed very quickly. Now, he says, I think I know what the answer is. The answer is that in our daily busy lives, we're so used to pressure of deadlines that when that pressure disappears, we no longer know if we're dead or alive. Congratulations, you now have a monthly deadline. And that monthly deadline has been keeping you busy. And when I finish talking to you, I'm going to go downstairs because the monthly deadline is due and I've got some check-in to do, etc. So that's job number one, which is of the four I still keep and which I hope I will keep as long as I can. And then my good friend, the Dean of Medicine, Bill Weber, when I was retiring, said, the President and I would like to nominate you for serving on the Board of Trustees of the Vancouver General Hospital. Mm-hmm. And I said, Bill, don't be stupid. I know nothing about doctors. I know nothing about medicine. I know nothing about hospitals. Why should I go on the board? Ah, he says, but you've been dean long enough and you know all about budgets, and that's why you put you on the board. So I said, all right, and that was what I call my course on continuing education, because all the things that I didn't know about in the course of my 7 years service on the board, I learned that about this and about that and the third thing. And I must say that professors are supposed to be prima donnas, doctors are supposed to be prima donnas, but when you come against a doctor who's a professor, oh boy, you got something. So my wife was laughing at me because when I retired, I said, well, now I'm through with 8 o'clock lectures, 8:30 lectures, I'm through with promotion tenure problems and stuff like that. Well, what do you know? The mm-hmm. people on the board, mm-hmm. apart from the retired ones, are busy people, and there are quite a number of meetings that start at 7:30 or 8 o'clock in the morning. So I...
There you are.
That was that. And the promotion and tenure committees, well, the first year I was there, one of the members of the medical staff was not recommended for reappointment by his colleagues, and he chose to fight it, and there was a big fight with court reporters mm-hmm. sitting there and so on. Mm-hmm. So my wife was again saying, I thought you weren't going to have any promotion or tenure mm-hmm. reviews. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was that. But being on the board, I again got on the treadmill and became second vice chairman and first vice chairman, then chairman of the board for a year, then past chairman for a board. And then after that, I said, well, now I've done it all. I wish to be released. And I was hoping that that would give a hint to the other past chairmen that were still sitting on the board, and some of them are still there. So that's mm-hmm. the way it goes. I don't really think that one should outstay one's welcome, mm-hmm. but that's my job number two. Job number three, again, the year before I retired as dean, I was invited to serve on a technical advisory committee to Atomic Energy of Canada and Nuclear Waste Management. Well, I stayed with that for 10 years, but last year again I said, well, I think whatever wise advice I could have given you, I have already given it, and you better mm-hmm. get somebody else. So mm-hmm. that was, and my fourth small job was I was president of the local ratepayers association in the university endowment.
Mm-hmm. Are you not editing also another, was it Canadian?
No, that was long ago.
That was long ago.
I was on that for about 6 years, and again, time to go.
What about the Professors Emeritus Group? Are you involved in that at all?
No, not at all.
You just are Professor Emeritus?
I'm a Professor Emeritus. I paid my $10 dues. Mm-hmm. I go to the meetings. I get very excited when they introduce the dental plan, which I'm now a member of. And that's it. They've done whatever I wanted them to do for me. And when they talk about setting up some gap fest on top of the Graduate Student Center, well, I say, I haven't got time for that.
Mm-hmm. So do you have any other, what are your projects that are on the shelf? I'm curious.
Well, I guess I have one project that I've been talking about for 30 years is to write up what we were talking about in a more formal way for the benefit of my children and grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't got around to it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And what sort of is my excuse for not doing it is that and my wife says, why don't you use a dictaphone? Because what I was planning to do, I mean, as I was talking about doing this project long, long ago, before I retired, I've never learned to type, unfortunately, in my career. And one of the worst things that happens when you retire is you lose your secretary. That really is a blow. And I kept on always telling my secretary, my administrative assistant, very good friend, Barry Wilson, that the first thing I will do when I retire is to teach myself how to type. So when I was retiring, she and the other ladies in the office presented me with a complete kit, with a book and all the things and so on. Well, I didn't get started on it. And my three daughters, each of whom now owns a computer, said, okay, Dad, you missed the typewriter bit. Keyboard is a little different from a typewriter. Why don't you sort of get started? And one of my daughters is, well, she's quite heavily involved in administration for CEDA. She has gone through several generations of computers, getting better and better ones. One of them, she sold to me for a small price and said, okay, Dad, now it's up to you. You've got a computer. Teach yourself how to type. Mm-hmm. And she produced a program.
A learning program. Mm-hmm.
Well, I actually sat down in front of the computer and I tried this thing, and the left hand I could operate more or less. The right hand, I discovered it was a problem, because when I pressed with this finger, that finger also hit, two fingers at once. It's this called the Dupuytren's. So that gave me an excuse. I can't learn to type, you see. I can't.
Oh, you can do it with your index finger.
I know. Well, no, I was going to do it properly, you see, properly. And therefore, the computer has been sitting around unused, and my daughter, when she flies through here every so often, she says, well, Dad, how far have you got? I said, I haven't turned it on since you were here last time.
You should tell your story, you know. You really, there'd be so many people interested.
Yeah. Well, my wife says you don't have to type. All you have to do is to dictate, because I do a lot of dictation. And one of these days, when I'm not so busy,
you can write it longhand and get somebody to type it for you, too.
Yeah. No, I think if I do it, it would be through a dictaphone, because I can do that faster than I can write.
Yeah.
But it's self-discipline that is lacking. Because it's the deadline part. You see, I always say to myself, well, I always get involved in too many things. First of all, I love traveling. And that comes first. I mean, before I sit down in front of a computer, if I got a chance to go to Tibet, as I did, yes. If I want to Northwest China and all that sort of stuff, yes. That's item number one on the agenda. Just because I'm a Russian-speaking scientist, I'm one of the not too many people in that category. as a physicist, as I started saying long ago, I'm no great shakes. I'm a competent, average, run-of-the-mill physicist. And if that was my only qualification, I would have done a lot less in my life than I was able to do because I'm a Russian-speaking physicist.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it came about was that in, I guess it was 56, I was on a committee of Canadian Association of Physicists to look into what kind of a big accelerator Canada might wish to get involved in. And we went to a big meeting in Geneva at the CERN laboratory. This is the big European collaboration. Conseil Européen de Recherche Nucléaire, known as CERN. And in Russian, it's also written CERN. So
that's easy.
CERN. So I was sitting sort of with my two colleagues way back because we just came as observers, we were not contributing. This was a big international discussion of high energy accelerators. And it happened to be the year in which the Russians at that time produced the world's biggest accelerator. It really was big. It was built on a now outdated principle and it required 36,000 tons of steel for the magnet. Now 36,000 tons of steel is big enough to build a destroyer, at least you can use that amount of steel. In fact, the Russians were joking. They said we had to melt down the Iron Curtain before we could build it. So they came for the first time in a decade. A large Russian delegation appeared because they had this new gadget. They were very proud of it, rightfully so. And the Western physicists were very eager to hear about it. And as long as it was formal presentation of papers which were prepared in Russia, there was a Russian text, there was an English text which has been vetted by English-speaking physicists and so on, and they had high-level translators from the United Nations who know all about fisheries and law of the sea and so on, but they don't know too much about physics.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as they had the previously prepared text, life was easy because the Russian would read two or three sentences and I had the two earphones and I could hear what was being said by the Russian, I could hear what was being said by the translator. Sometimes they were in phase, sometimes they were out of phase because it didn't matter for the people that only knew the one language, they disregarded the other one. However, when the thing was finished and the question period started, then the Western physicists were eager to ask questions. The Russians were eager to answer, but the translators got completely mixed up. I mean, it just became a shambles.
Yeah.
So the chairman of CERN said, I see Professor Volkov sitting up there. He might be able to help us. Well, I've never done any translating, certainly not in public.
Mm-hmm.
And I came forth and said, well, I'm not a trained simultaneous interpreter, so all I can do is attempt consecutive translation. So you say a few sentences, I'll say stop, translate, you answer, stop, translate.
Yeah.
And that worked. So by the time the conference was finished, I was able to tell my Canadian friend, I can't be an expert in every field. And I could go to my own conferences, but not to everybody else's conferences. But on the strength of that, I got invited to everybody else's conference as well. So that my combination of love of travel really got a great boost from the fact that I was a Russian-speaking person.
Now, do your children speak Russian? Did you teach them?
Well, we didn't teach them. They resisted, and later on, they had to learn on their own, and the only way you can learn is when you want to do it. So
yeah.
Our eldest daughter speaks, I would say, reasonable Russian at about the 15-year-old level because she has not been reading, and the way you acquire vocabulary is by reading.
Mm-hmm.
And the two twins, younger ones, they speak Russian with a very funny accent, and their vocabulary is limited. But the unfortunate part was that as they were growing up, We didn't have a secret language because my wife and I couldn't discuss things in front of them in Russian because they managed to understand.
They understand, of course.
Well, I think that's probably enough, don't you?
I think that's wonderful.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.